All right, everybody, welcome back to Hogcast, the official podcast of the 442nd Fighter Wing. I'm Bob Jennings, the Superintendent of Public Affairs, and I'm sitting across the table from Colonel Mike Rio Leonis, the Wing Commander. And we also have a special guest here with us today who we will introduce later, and he has a great story to tell. But before we get into that, it's babble time.
Yeah. Hey, Bob. Thanks. Yeah, we have a great story coming up with a pretty unique deployment to a unique location in Niger. And I don't know if you're tracking the news. Niger is still a deployment location, but possibly kind of going through some changes. So it'll be interesting to see what he did last summer. And that's Sergeant Adam Lambert. But babble time. This is babble time number three. And if you recall, every time I babble, I throw $25 on the table. So up to $75 now, Bob. And if anyone can figure why this is called babble time. Had a couple guesses. You, of course, guessed. Pretty advanced logic. Kind of expanded my vision of how your brain works. It was a pretty advanced calculation to get to the babble thing.
These are the thoughts that keep me up at night.
Okay, I'd recommend stop thinking about me at night. And then Master Sergeant Gardner from the 476 has guessed twice. Her first guess was kind of making fun of me personally, but her second guess was not quite as pointed, but I appreciate her chiming in, and she chimes in from Estonia. She's a TR, and her husband has a job in Estonia, so she's accompanied him, and she talks about Old Town a little bit. Last correspondence via email, they finally put out the outdoor seating for the numerous restaurants and bars out there, and it promptly snowed. So I guess we should appreciate our winner versus an Estonian winner. But anyways, getting into babble time. So March flowing into the April UTA was kind of busy. One of the big things that we did in the wing is we did a CI2 event, an improvement event, information flow. Bob, you were involved with that, which I appreciate it.
And I was. That was pretty intense.
Pretty intense. Shallon Troutman ran that, and you went through a very formal process to come up with, I guess you could say, countermeasures. And that was, you know, how many steps did you have to go through to get to the end result, which were countermeasures?
So it was an 8-step process, which is the formal Air Force improvement process. We went through the first 5 steps over the 3-day event, which was basically to the point where we're forming the countermeasures and deciding who's going to be responsible for what. And then it created about 6 months of work on the back end, where we divided up into working groups to each tackle a different portion of what we needed to do to help fix our information flow in the wing.
Awesome. And you know, that's something that, you know, Commander Instinct, I realized, was a problem and had made some changes. And then you guys were able to validate that and then come up with some techniques and, you know, procedures and improvements so that we are fixing our information flow in the wing, and hopefully we'll notice a change in the next 6 months. So thanks for being part of the team. The team was an absolute cross-section of the wing. Every organization was represented, every status, every age group as well. So great team put together, and Lieutenant Colonel Chevalier ran that team with Shallon's guidance, and I think it worked out great, and we hope to improve information flow in the wing. So real big event there for the wing. I went to Wing Commander School down at Robbins. It was really informative, and I won't go into the details. Normally, I sleep through academic courses and stuff like that, and I did not in this one. This was definitely useful and professionally run, and I'll tell you what, I'll summarize everything. Pretty much the first thing when the Deputy Commander of AFRIC came in, General Pennington, he said, our job as an Air Force Reserve Command is to provide combat-ready airmen. And that's the bottom line. So, you know, I talk about lead well, train hard, ready now. That's our job from top to bottom, is being ready now. So I'll continue to say the lead well, train hard, ready now, and, you know, the task board, which organizes our training and organizes our effort. There's two priorities, and one of them is ready now, pretty clear. And if we always are focusing towards that, we're in good shape. The budget passed, which was huge, and obviously kind of had almost a government shutdown, but that now is actually flowing the monies into the pockets. Even though we were kind of guessing what the budget's going to be, we're now being able to spend the actual funding, which is good. The biggest thing that happened in March was the GIF map was signed, 26 March. And why is that big and important for us? Well, the GIF map was the trigger that generated our RCP deployments. And those taskings started to flow down, and our RPI, Craig Burton, is starting to execute those taskings, and hopefully these orders will come to our deployers as soon as possible, because they're missing out on benefits right now. 6 months is the line that they start drawing TRICARE pre-deployment benefits, and we're inside of that. It's an emphasis item to me, but it's quite honestly an emphasis item all the way up the chain to include Congress, who passed those laws. So the GIF map was signed, and those orders are going to come down as quickly as possible. And my promise to the wing was to surge when those orders come down so that we get our members on orders and get their benefits. So we had some promotions in the wing. Our colonel's board came back, and we got two promoted to colonel. Lieutenant Colonel Riker is a colonel select, the commander of Civil Engineering Squadron. And then Lieutenant Colonel Kramer, kind of a newer guy into our wing. He's running our XP. He was also promoted colonel. So if you get to see those guys, that give them congratulations. We had some people go to the Pentagon and run some trips there. And, I think they were almost overwhelmed and surprised at how much the focus of that building is on the great power competition, specifically China. And, we talk about it. We talk about how the Air Force is reorganizing based on the GPC. But in reality, maybe we're not fathoming how big of a change that is for our organization. Obviously, they did some major changes in regards to things that don't directly affect us. They being, Secretary of the Air Force and his initiatives. The biggest thing is the deployable combat wing is going to be the unit of action. And we're well set up for that change, being that we have basically the aviation package and the support package, and we are a tenant unit on a host base. Quite honestly, Bob, if we packed up and left, nothing would really change to Whiteman Air Force Base and the mission here, other than the traffic pattern would get a little bit quieter and maybe the gate would get a little bit slower in the morning. But bottom line, we're in a perfect position to pick up and move and deploy as a wing. And hopefully we'll see that as a change that we execute and train to in the future. And I don't know how that looks, but hopefully we'll train and work and deploy together. And then when we get a combat tasking, we'll go together. So some other interesting things that occurred, not interesting, this is a great thing. I hired Chief Master Sergeant Nate Parks as the new command chief. We obviously, I like to say this about Chris Berrien, he stayed on for me. So General Schultz hired Chris Berrien. Chris Berrien survived General Nestor. And then Colonel Leonis Rio ran him off. So when I took command, I asked him to stay on for a year, and his eyes went really big and goes, a year? And then we kind of sorted out that 6 months was about right. And we had a great selection to choose from, but I chose Nate Parks. Do you remember Nate Parks when he was here before?
Yes, he actually co-hosted General Nestor's last podcast.
Yeah, absolutely. And quite honestly, the podcast is kind of his idea. He did it at Grissom, and General Nestor saw how effective it was. So when Chief Parks is on station, he will join us and we'll do a Babel and Rosa time. I'll have him in the room with me. He's going to be on full-time orders, and he's going to be a great addition to the wing. He has some history here, and he's coming out of the Chief's group at the Pentagon. So he has some, we'll call it higher building knowledge that he'll bring to our Central Missouri unit and hopefully help us continue on. So really excited with that. He actually was out here during the next thing I'm going to talk about, which was our offsite. After the April UTA, we had a one-day offsite. Bob, you were there. What'd you think of that one day?
I mean, I learned a lot. It's not often that I sit in a room and I'm the dumbest person in there, but that's happened to me twice in the last month. First with the CI2 event, and then with the leadership offsite, there was so much knowledge and so much experience packed into both of those rooms that it was impressive. But you talk about you ran Chief Berrien off. As reluctant as he was to leave at his going away, I think that's kind of a stretch. Well, I think he would have stayed indefinitely.
I think he sincerely asked him to. Yeah, I think he really enjoyed coming to our wing, and some of the values and the cohesiveness and just the culture of our wing, I think he had no idea. And I think it hit him pretty hard when he was getting his gifts. And part of the offsite was Sunday night.
Sunday
night. And we went to Jay Rieger's distillery in the Bottoms there in Kansas City. And it was just an incredible historic building, incredible venue, great food, you know, great drinks, obviously. We obviously all had designated drivers or Ubers, but we did a good send off to him. And, you know, he got a little emotional. I bought him, what did I call it? A correction. You know, he wears those straight billed hats. And if anyone doesn't know, he is from California and he's a San Francisco 49ers fan. And at our awards banquet, you know, I happened to find a Chiefs jersey in the Wing Commander's closet in the office there. And I rode in with that. And I didn't realize, but independently, he put on a, it looked like an 80s era 49ers, you know, almost a silk jacket. And he rode in on that. And I kind of didn't process that he was the opposite when it came to the Super Bowl. But so what I did is I bought him a flat-billed hat. And it was a Kansas City Chief, all black to include the emblem there. So he put it on, and hopefully he'll wear it with pride in the Bay Area.
If you want to see the shame on his face as he's wearing it, it's on our Facebook page.
But anyway, so that was a good send-off of a great command chief, made some great, great strides here as a leader, and you know has mentored our first sergeants to what I would consider the best cadre of first sergeants that, that I've seen since I've been in the wing. Note, the off-site, we did a lot of educational stuff, but the keynote speaker was John Sherman, the owner of the Kansas City Royals. He also brought, and I think kind of almost as a protection mechanism, Joel Goldberg, who's kind of the voice of the Royals. He's not the play-by-play guy, but he does a lot of the on-the-field interviews and stuff like that. So he's, you know, obviously handy with the mic, handy with words, and he and John Sherman went back and forth real well. And just an amazing, you know, here's a CEO of an MLB baseball team. And, you know, you figure, hey, you know, obviously he bought the team because he had success outside of Major League Baseball as a businessman. But the correlation of success in business versus leadership in a military organization, you know, you sometimes wonder if there's correlation there. And he spoke for, what, about 50 minutes? And I took, here's a page of notes, and it's basically, I started, it's one of my old calendars. I'm kind of a disaster when it comes to organization. Here's the, if you could see this, you'd laugh. Here are the notes for the the next segment. And then this was the notes I took from John's wisdom is the best way to describe it. And I'll just go over this, and then we'll bring in Adam, Master Sergeant Lambert, and talk about that great, great war story. You know, basically team first. And he talked about, hey, the team's first. And, you know, we talk about the, you know, mission first, the unit first, people first. There's good correlation to there. They made a huge signing of Bobby Witt Jr. And they talked about how, you know, he basically committed his Major League Baseball career to the Kansas City Royals. And the trigger that allowed that commitment to go through, I think it was a 10-year contract, is that he felt that the Royals were committed to winning. And, you know, I think that may be not the case previous ownership, but this new ownership group obviously had that commitment, and Bobby Witt Jr. felt comfortable with that. So commitment to winning, commitment to the mission is something that we have, I'd say, in common. He said, what is certain is uncertainty. And I think anything aligned with the government when it comes to money, budget, stuff like that is valid. And then, you know, look at the world, what's going on in the world. I mean, every time you turn on the news, something's going on in another region that we have a mission in as a United States. It's kind of crazy. Take care of your people. We talk about that in any leader. That's the first thing that they should think about, in my opinion. How did the Royals emulate that concept? Is they started paying the minor league players and staffs first during COVID. So they were the first organization to start paying their minor league system when the COVID pandemic hit.
And he even said that the upper echelon of leadership took pay cuts to make sure that happened.
I didn't catch that, but that's awesome. And a huge, huge representation of that leadership that they had in the upper chamber, I guess you'd say. Mentoring in the locker room. So we talk about mentoring airmen. What they've done in the locker room this year is they, first of all, they mixed all the players up. So you don't have the pitchers area, you don't have the infielders area. You basically, in the veterans area, they mix people up and they put veterans at the corners. So, you know, I don't know if the cornered lockers are better, thus the veterans get them, but the mentoring based on the position in the locker room is basically forced. So that's something that they said they saw an immediate impact and a team being formed based on how they set the locker room up. And such a small thing drives mentoring. He said, be decisive, but thoughtful. Don't panic. and I've always talked about, you know, you need to take the white space to make a decision. Your initial reaction might not be the right decision, even though in the military it's like snap. What's a perfect example of that? Remember when we had the gun accident where the bullet shot out of the gun on the ground? We had a meeting and we were going to do something that wasn't probably the best move. And we actually had, I remember Chief Kelly, this was at the end of the meeting, Chief Kelly, the senior enlisted leader for the MXS, he gets up, or he at the very end says, guys, and he basically expressed, I don't think this is the right thing to do. He could have just let this ride and we would have done something. And he specifically stopped that action that we had maybe too quickly formed as a plan of the COA. And, you know, I'll remember that comment. I was like, thank you, Chief Kelly, for stepping up when the meeting was basically over. Data-driven decisions, but you need to put some leadership on that. So, you know, don't blindly react to the data. Throw some instinct on it. I call it commander's instinct, supervisor's instinct, the leader's instinct is what he said. There's never zero risk. That's absolutely sure in our business. You know, strive to punch above your weight. And I guess that's a small market mentality, but, you know, if you look at what our unit does in every corner of our wing, you know, what the ops group does in regards to the customers they're working with, that's well above any A-10. What our maintenance does with reduced manning, how they produce high-level stories specifically when we're deployed, absolutely in combat, that's above our weight. Never missed a combat sortie. What the support group does every time they go somewhere, you know, maybe they're hesitant that the reserves are here until they're there and they make an impact and, you know, please stay longer, please come back is the standard what our support group sees. And same thing with our medical when they deploy. So incredible. And then Moody, obviously, you know, I went down there and their support for the 23rd Wing, you know, they're critical to the F-35 transition and, you know, critical to the operations down there, specifically their instructor corps, their senior maintenance function. So we punch above our weight everywhere. Simple messaging is important. So, you know, lead well, train hard, ready now is my simple messaging. I told them downtown baseball is awesome. You know, they obviously want to get that stadium approved. And there's a simple message there, Royals, downtown baseball is awesome. Hire well, honest and open. These are all things that we've talked about over the last 6 months or so. And, you know, it was repeated without prompting by John Sherman. Take risk, you can deal with the downside. You know, that's the first time I've heard that. You know, we take risk at every turn. Can you deal with the downside? Trust and buy-in for a desired result. You know, these are all just common sense leadership principles. And then visible leaders. So, you know, don't be in your office as a leader. Check an email. Get out and about as much as possible. And build that trust and buy-in in the unit. So huge, huge benefit to having him come out to the keynote speaker. So any other observations of that there, Bob?
I think what stuck with me the most about his speech was the emphasis he put on resilience. Because, you know, they had a setback a couple of weeks ago. And, you know, he said, oh, well, that sucks. We're going to go back to the drawing board. We're going to figure it out. And we're going to try again.
Yep.
And that, I think, really made an impression.
Yep. And, you know, one of the big things, he bought the team, boom, COVID hits. You know, so he's so excited owning a team he grew up with. And then it's under financial strain that seats are empty because of the pandemic. So that's resiliency. And he obviously turned the corner and they're having a pretty good season so far. So I wish them continued success. Guess what? They talked about reach versus revenue. You know, if they start reaching the top of the standings, and have a good team, they're going to load that stadium up because that's what we want in the region's winning. And those stands will be full on Wednesday afternoon if they start winning like they are early season. So I wish them success and hopefully they'll keep it going. All right, final thing before we talk to Adam and hear his war stories, the Hunger Games. And this actually was highlighted on a national publication. I don't know if it was military.com or Air Force Times, but 10th Air Force is doing a competition among the wings called the Hunger Games. And I won't go into the details, we talk about it, but you know, there's about a dozen plus items that they're looking at each wing and adding them up and coming up with a total score. We'll call ourselves in the bottom third, but over the last 2 months, we've actually made the biggest gains. So great work by our wing. And you know, we've kind of targeted the things that we can impact in short order. But when we had our last feedback, we got called out in the positive 4 times. So out of the dozen topics, 4 of them we are achieving higher than anyone else in 10th Air Force. So I appreciate everybody's efforts in that. So anyways, Bob, that's all I got for Babel Time. Again, $75 on the table for anyone who can tell us what Babel Time is about. Why is it Babel Time?
Is it maybe because this 15-minute babble time has lasted 24 so far?
That is not it, Bob.
Oh, again, well,
another target at me, just like Sergeant Gardner. That's okay. I'll take it. When we get in the triple digits, I'll start throwing out hints, and hopefully someone will take some money away. If this goes, you know, if this goes a year, someone's going to take a big chunk of cash. I hope someone figures it out. All right, let's talk to Master Sergeant Adam Lambert and hear about his combat deployment last summer to Niger. Hey, all right, guys. So I got a great story here. Sitting across the table with Master Sergeant Adam Lambert. He is in the LRS, but when we get through his story, you'll see he can fill positions in the CE Squadron, Security Forces Squadron, and the FSS Squadron as well, based on his deployment to Niger. He went to Niger in 18th of May, and he came back around October 6th of 2023. And Adam, very humble airman here, pulling the story, and it's just an incredible story. So we'll get to Adam. So Adam, give us the details. What number deployment is this for you?
So I do believe it's number 6.
Number 6. And I might have said it already, but where did you end up going?
Yeah, it was Airbase 101. It's Niamey, Niger.
Niamey, Niger. First 442nd member to go to Niger. He actually went with a number member of our wing from CE. Didn't really know him until that member from CE showed up on base. Did you pick him up in the bus or something like that? Or
at that point, I wasn't driving the bus.
Okay.
But I made sure to meet him there. I knew he was coming in, so I wanted to welcome him.
Awesome. Thanks for being a 442nd family member and making sure the second member to deploy to Niger felt welcome. Interesting, if you look at the map of Niger, you know, at first it took me a second to find it. It's basically Central Africa or North Central Africa. And the capital is in, I'd call it, it almost is like a peninsula in the southwest corner. And the town is called, you can pronounce it better than me.
Niamey.
There is an airport there that the Air Force and Army have a compound or an admission. And Adam, it sounds like the Air Force squadron of drones was supporting an Army training mission where they're training the special forces of Niger. Is that what you guys are doing down there?
That's about the best way to describe it, yeah.
And what was your specific role in that squadron?
Primarily just fixing vehicles.
Okay.
For the Air Force side.
Vehicle maintenance, and you've been doing that your whole career, is that correct?
Yes, sir.
And that career started in the Army, correct?
Yeah, back in 94.
And then when did we come to 442nd?
The end of 1999.
So, wow, a member since 1999 and deployed to Niger on his 6th deployment. Are you going to deploy again?
Yeah, a few more months.
Yep, a few more months going out the door. And I said, hey, did you waive your dwell? And he said, no, I actually volunteered for this deployment to Niger, so he didn't have dwell. And I asked him if he wanted to go on this next deployment. He said, absolutely. So again, an airman leaning forward and doing the mission downrange. So let's talk about, did you have any different training required to go to Niger than, for example, Afghanistan or any of your previous deployments?
Yes. Did ARC Corps, which is a lot of weapons handling. I think they're adding some more driving skills into it.
Okay.
It used to be, they called it something else before. They had like the outside the wire, inside the wire training.
Okay.
But then ECAC.
ECAC. Yeah, I've heard that acronym. Yeah. What did that training entail?
That's teaching you how to evade capture.
Okay.
And then how to act if you do get captured.
Okay, gotcha. So I think some of the pilots go through SERE.
Yeah.
Survival, evasion, resistance, escape. It's just more the evasion and resistance, it sounds like.
Yes.
And was it applicable to where you were going, which was an urban setting?
I think it is.
Okay.
I honestly think the Air Force should send everybody through it.
Okay. Well, that's a good point. We'll probably have a CBT on that next month. So
you couldn't CBT that one.
You couldn't CBT that. Good. I'll put that in there. So you obviously traveled all by yourself. which, you know, obviously six deployment, it wasn't probably a difficult thing to do. Yeah. But, you know, I always think about the senior airman that's deploying for the first time, mm-hmm. that is not deploying with a unit, having to travel to Niger by themselves. And that's why one of the things the Air Force is doing is trying to deploy wings so we can mm-hmm. train and deploy together. So that must have been challenging. And another thing the wing has done recently is try to be more proactive in our actual taskings, so that we aren't going to so many different locations, because I want people to kind of be together as the wing, a family. So traveling by yourself, how did you get to Niger?
Yeah, C-17.
Okay.
Nice early morning flight.
And that was out of Germany, correct?
Yeah, out of Germany.
So commercial to Germany, and then a C-17 into this, we'll call it civilian airfield with many compounds of our allies. So you gave me a list. Why don't you give me a list of the compounds that were on that base?
So, of course, yeah, the American and Italian shared with us.
Okay, Americans and Italians.
French were our next-door neighbors.
French.
And then we had the Germans, some Belgians, and Canadians.
Canadians. Well. And you initially were sharing the facilities with the Italians, but they're also building their own yes. compound, you mentioned. So
yeah.
Did you have the benefits of European cuisine in these compounds? Could you go get French food and then German food and then Italian food?
We had to go with the chaplain. He would set it up and we could go to their compounds,
okay.
Eat at their DFACs. The Italians shared a DFAC with us.
Okay.
The French food was phenomenal.
Okay, so hopefully you were good friends with the chaplain and were able to jump around, but I think that's funny. Was our DFAC food the same type of food that you had in previous deployments?
No.
Not quite, huh?
It wasn't up to even deployment standards.
Okay, so, but it was a food line and not eating MREs and stuff like that. It wasn't Halliburton level?
It was Hot Meals. Well,
Hot Meals, okay. Yeah. So the worst food you've had in a deployment, would that
yes.
be true? Okay,
yes.
So worst food. How long has that base been there? Do you know?
I wouldn't say like 2014, 2015.
Okay.
Something like that.
So it's been there probably around 10 years.
Yeah.
And again, we are supporting a training mission that the Army's doing. About 200
I think it's,
Air Force members?
Yeah, it was around 200.
How many vehicle maintenance did they have in your shop?
Two of us.
Just two people?
Two people.
How many, and you're only maintaining Air Force vehicles?
Yes.
Unless you had to augment other services or other countries.
Right.
So, interesting profile of allies there. It's interesting that you got to eat food, French food. I buy that being the worst. Got to be better than the German food, right? But I would have liked to balance between Italian and French, personally. Okay, so I'm looking at the Google Earth, and the airfield is east-west. The compounds are within the perimeter of the airfield. And you told me that the airfield was surrounded in general by, what was the security measures around the airfield?
Around the airfield's just chain link fenced.
Chain link fenced. And then it looks like in the was that northwest? Northwest corner-ish, west side of the perimeter, mm-hmm. right up against the city, it looked like.
Yes.
Was the military or the living compounds and feeding compounds of our allies. And they were a bit more secure, is that true?
Yeah, our compounds were much more secure than the main bases.
Okay. And were all the compounds, could you walk freely between them all, or were they independently guarded?
Independently guarded.
Okay, independently guarded. So that's why you needed the chaplain to mm-hmm. bounce between them.
Yeah.
What was the security around each compound?
Most of them were single point entry.
Okay.
With, you know, your usual security forces.
Okay. Did they have those concrete T-walls?
Yes.
Okay. So you couldn't see outside once you came into your
Correct.
Compound. And they had towers as well?
Yes.
We'll get to that a little bit later. I asked where the Nigerian military was housed and how were they housed on the airfield?
They basically just had huts.
Okay.
A lot of it made out of those big sand bricks. I can't think of what you call them right now.
Cinder blocks?
No, they're the big metal wire casing.
Okay.
That's full of rocks.
The HESCOs?
HESCOs.
Okay.
There we go.
Gotcha. So yeah. They didn't really have a good infrastructure on the base that was theirs.
No.
Okay. How often did you interact with the Nigerian military?
The Air Force guys. Almost daily.
Okay.
I seen what kind of conditions they had. They had these big water containers that were yellow water, And so I would sneak a couple of cases of water and drop off to them every day. And
awesome.
Yeah.
They'd appreciate that.
Oh, they absolutely did.
You know, isn't it incredible that your currency is water over there?
Yeah.
you told me, what did the place smell like overall?
Oh, it was not good.
Okay. Did you ever get used to that?
I think when I landed on the way back, I landed in Sicily, and I noticed that the air didn't smell.
Okay. So in Sicily, huh? Gotcha. That's kind of funny. So the Nigerian Air Force members, were they able to speak English? Were you able to communicate with them at all?
They spoke very little English, but you could tell through gestures how, you know, thankful they were for
right.
stuff. I would say maybe about 15 words is about the most you can get out of one of them.
Gotcha. But they were accepting of our presence on the base, and they were happy to be there.
Oh, yes.
So
yes.
Did you make any interaction with the Army unit that was training the Nigerian Special Forces?
Yeah, our Army guys there were fantastic.
Okay.
They were really good guys.
Do you know, were they all special operators, or, you know, they obviously had a bigger presence than we did?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's Green Berets. That's about all I...
Gotcha. Awesome. And were they doing their training on the airfield, or were they leaving?
They left.
Okay.
Yeah.
So they were on and off the base, and did you get any stories or interactions from their time away from the airfield?
No, unfortunately, I didn't get to know many of them until after.
We'll get to the after here in a little bit. So back and forth, working on vehicles. How many vehicles, what was the inventory level of the vehicles?
I think we had 86.
86 vehicles that two dudes were responsible for maintaining.
Yeah.
Did most of these vehicles stay on the airfield support, or did a lot of the vehicles go off base? And
pretty much they all stayed on base.
Okay.
Minus, you know, security forces. They
right.
Others, but.
New vehicles, old vehicles, what was the cross-section there?
Mostly old.
Okay.
My mobile truck was a 1999.
Okay, 1999.
I could see through the floor.
Okay.
Yeah.
And
the air conditioner worked.
Apparently you mentioned that we'll get to your living quarters here with the air conditioner work, but a 1999 vehicle, that's when you joined our unit. So
yeah,
that's what you get. So if you joined our unit later, you'll get a newer vehicle, right? Is that, I don't think that's good. So, and this was the vehicle that you actually transported, you and your vehicle maintainer, back and forth to work?
Yes, sir.
Did everybody have their own vehicle, or is that just a benefit of being in vehicle maintenance?
Well, we had to have the mobile truck.
Okay.
We actually still had two other vehicles, which were both newer.
Okay.
I mean, nice little SUVs.
Okay.
And we just kept them down at the shop.
Gotcha.
I was like, we've got this. We'll
gotcha.
Be fine.
What type of vehicle is it? Just so.
The Mitsubishi. Oh, I can't think which.
Montero or
Montero,
something.
Yeah, I think it's, yeah, the Montero. Actually.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
So these were not vehicles we necessarily flew in. These were vehicles that we procured on the local economy.
Yeah, they were all lease.
Okay. Awesome.
So I managed a lease program over there.
Okay.
For vehicle maintenance. So we had two that were assigned to us.
Okay.
But if somebody's broke down and we had to send it out for repair, I just gave them one of those to use.
Okay. So were all the vehicles that we had in the Air Force inventory lease vehicles?
No.
Okay.
Just the Monteros.
Okay. Just the Monteros.
Yeah.
Awesome. So that's another program that vehicle maintenance, you actually maintain the inventory.
Yes.
As well. Okay. Any challenges there, or was that not a big deal?
That was actually pretty easy. The contractor for lease spoke perfect English.
Okay.
Really good dude. Muhammad's name.
Awesome.
I wanted a hug every time you saw him.
Okay.
So he got a hug.
Good. You know, whatever makes the business work, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Excellent. Were you doing maintenance on vehicles that were not Air Force vehicles?
Did some on the Italian fleet.
Okay.
They didn't have a mechanic there, and they had one forklift, and it got used a lot.
Okay.
And it was going to be 3 or 4 weeks to get parts in and or to get another forklift flown in. So pulled the radiator and had to clean it out and then patch a few holes and put it back in and got them all going in a day, and so they could continue their mission.
Yep, so we'll say you're doing jobs outside the standard Air Force vehicle maintenance,
yeah.
AFIs, and just kind of making it happen, you know, using your skill set to help others. And obviously building relations with Niger. So everything was kind of normal for the first 5 months. Is that correct?
Well, first, till July 26th.
July 26th. What happened on July 26th?
Well, about, I don't know, 1 or 2 in the morning, the Niger's equivalent to Secret Service overthrew their government, arrested the president, and took the country over.
Gotcha. So there was a coup.
Yes.
You know, I think, you know, obviously there, South America, I went down there in Peru earlier or last year. There's coups down there all the time, but I assume that there's coups in Africa. And obviously here, Sergeant Lambert's in the middle of one. So what were the signs from the base that there was a coup? You said there were some limited signs, but not a whole bunch.
Well, I mean, the first thing I knew of it was getting a phone call that I had to go report to security forces.
Okay.
That was my first sign.
So did the protesters at the gate happen after this incident?
Yes.
Okay. So let's go to the, you know, this is where the military capable man. Obviously, he's using his skills to maintain, we'll call them, other than Air Force vehicles. But this is the part of the story where I am just kind of blown away of a military capable airman. So you're at work, mm-hmm. and it's hot. So what are you wearing?
I'm wearing a pair of Dickie shorts and a Dickie shirt with the sleeves ripped off.
Yep. that's right in accordance with the Air Force standards there.
And probably a boonie cap.
And a boonie cap. Most okay. likely. Excellent. And you're in blue shorts, basically.
Yes.
Yeah. And you get a phone call from who?
From, I can't remember her name, but from security forces.
Okay.
She ran the program. Camacho, that was her name.
Camacho.
Yeah. She ran the program for augmentees and called down and said, hey, you got to come gear up.
Okay, so you were identified as a security forces augmentee prior to this.
Yes.
Did you have any additional training to be an augmentee, or you just identified?
At first it was identified, and then they actually put us in with TCCC classes, like
okay.
advanced classes,
okay.
with the Army, their medics,
okay.
along with security forces and some of the Green Berets as far as handling tactics, things like that.
Okay. How much training was that?
It was every Saturday for about 2 hours.
Okay. So you did you feel comfortable being an augmentee after that training?
I thought I did.
Okay. So anyways, Camacho calls you, and then she shows up in a what type of vehicle?
A up armored Land Cruiser.
Okay. Awesome.
Picks me up from my shop to drive me back to the main base.
And it was you and your fellow shopmate.
Yep.
And where was your fellow shopmate from, by the way?
He was out of Spangdahlem.
Spangdahlem. Okay. So keep going. What happens next?
Yeah, we took us back up there, got us armed up, and we're still in our blue uniform.
Okay. Shorts and cut-off sleeves.
Cut-off sleeves.
No time to change.
No time to change. Throw on your battle rattle. Here's your M4. Here's your weapon. You know, here's your ammo. Get back in the Land Cruiser. We're going back down to your shop. And got down there, and they put him at the front gate to our compound. And
okay.
And put me in the tower guarding the front gate.
Okay, so bottom line, did you have to go back to your compound to get your battle rattle?
No, it traveled with me every day.
Okay, so you had your battle rattle with you all the time, so you just had to put that on.
Yeah.
But you went past your clothing, you know, your uniform, let's
yes.
just say, to get armed.
Yep.
She would not allow you to change.
No change.
She took you back up in your shorts, cut off sleeves, Rambo, and you are in a guard tower.
Yep.
With an M4?
I had the M4.
Which you're qualified on, I assume?
Yes.
And what else did you have?
And then there was a SAW.
There was a SAW, which is a small automatic weapon.
Yeah.
It's basically, what caliber is that thing?
I don't know if that one's the 240s.
Okay.
So,
yeah, I'm not.
Like that.
We should have maybe prepped this so we don't look stupid. But yeah, so bottom line, it's not a 50 cal.
No.
A chain gun, but it is a chain gun.
Yeah.
It is a pretty heavy weapon. It has a handle that you carry it with, and usually they shoot it off a tripod.
Yeah.
And was that thing mounted up there?
It's mounted.
Okay. And she provided training for the SAW. What was the training?
Point this direction and pull the trigger.
Okay. So no kidding, 5 seconds of training.
Yeah.
Okay. And now you are a security forces defender augmentee guarding your compound with a weapon that you had 5 seconds of training on.
Yes.
So multi-capable airman right there in shorts and a cut off blue uniform. And that is just an awesome story that, you know, I had to pull that out of you, by the way. Should have led with that and just showing, you know, here's a multi-capable airman. Obviously you were trained and knew you were going to be an augmentee, but quite honestly, they probably didn't tell you how to guard a tower.
Oh, no.
They certainly didn't tell you how to run the SAW. And so that was right after the coup.
Yes.
And how long did that duty last?
I was in tower for about a week and a half.
Week and a half.
12-hour shift.
It was it all daylight? Did you at least get daylight?
At least got daylight.
Okay. And 12-hour shifts with the SAW. The second day, though, what was different?
I had to put my uniform
on. You had your OCPs on before the battle rattle. Is there a photo out there with you?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
I kind of want to get that photo.
I think you might have it.
And you're talking day one photo.
Yeah.
That is awesome. We got to get that out there. So, you know, we talk about, you know, basic training or BMT has changed, that people are going to come out with that mentality of multi-capable airmen, but I guarantee it's not going to be to the level that you performed as a surprise day after the coup in Niger. So you told me that the coup wasn't a one-day event. There was actually some continued conflict. How long did that conflict occur and what happened referenced the sides of the coup?
Well, we had the protesters outside the gate.
Okay, let's get to that. So
that was maybe 3-4 days after.
Okay.
Nonstop protests day and night. I don't know if they took shifts. I know they played loud music all night.
Okay.
Made it a little difficult to sleep at times.
And that main gate was actually, again, you're on the west side of the compound, maybe or west side of the airfield mm-hmm. perimeter, and that main gate was, you know, you were on northwest, and that main gate was like center west.
Yes.
So it was kind of south of you, but your compound is right up against that west perimeter.
Close.
Okay. How many people, did you ever put eyes on that protest?
You could see a little bit out there.
Okay.
Not very well.
Do you know what they were protesting?
The French.
They were protesting the French.
They wanted the French out of there.
They wanted the French. And this is, I assume, a French colony?
Yes.
Okay. Was. So a French colony, they want the French out of there. And the French were right up against the perimeter, which I believe.
Yeah.
Based on what you tell, probably eating their fine food as they're getting booted out of the country. Do you remember the numbers? Can you throw an estimate?
For the protesters?
Yes.
I think they told us like 10 to 12,000.
Holy cow.
Yeah.
So you heard the protests, you saw them, obviously didn't go up close.
No.
who was responsible for that main gate?
Niger's military.
Okay. I'm sure we were keeping an eye on it as well.
Oh, yes.
Okay. Anyway, so protests are going on, but about 3 or 4 days later, what happens?
Well, the part with the protesters making it on base.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's about 6 of those got on base.
Okay.
They didn't make it back off the way they wanted.
Yep. You said that you obviously weren't eyeing the gate, but you said that you heard, we'll call it the final event of that
yes.
breach.
That was one of the technicals that they have over there was took the final shot, took down the last guy.
Yeah, super loud?
Super loud. I mean, it's, what is that, a 19 millimeter?
Okay.
That's what they had on those.
Wow, okay.
So, yeah, it's
woke you up, everybody jumps?
Yes.
Did someone disclose what happened later so you knew it was just
yeah.
And was it, how long was the shot?
It probably wasn't more than 100 yards from.
Okay. So, I mean, time-wise, was it just like boom, 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 and it was over?
Yeah,
okay,
pretty much.
Okay, so obviously the Niger army taking care of business, mm-hmm. and I assume the protesters didn't want to breach after that. So you said 6 protesters yeah. were killed in that breach. So interesting. So that, you know, obviously, you know, 10,000 protesters trying to get on base and obviously unsuccessful in this case. All right, so after the coup, the profile of the Air Force presence changed.
Yes.
How quickly did those decisions get made before you went into a drawdown state?
I think it was about maybe a week and a half, 2 weeks.
Okay. And how did that drawdown go? You said you had about 200 people originally. How quickly did we get people out of there and who left first?
Pretty much everybody that left at the same time, which we went from around 200 down to probably 120, 130.
Okay.
Most of that was defenders.
Okay, so the defenders stayed back, the commanders stayed back.
Yeah.
Any other functional areas that kind of remained that they felt was essential?
They were keeping POL.
Okay.
Because if jets are coming in, they've that and diesel fuel for the generators.
Okay.
But pretty much most of everybody else they were trying to send out of there.
Okay. And it wasn't a permanent retrograde, it was kind of a redux to min staffing?
Well, they were talking retrograde at first. Like full retrograde.
Okay.
And then it kind of up and down, up and down.
What did they do with the drones during that drawdown?
We ended up, they wouldn't let us fly them out.
Okay.
Well, as far as actually flying the drones themselves.
Right.
So they were broke down, put in crates, and took off on a C-17.
Okay. So initially you were scheduled to be as part of the drawdown.
Yes.
And was it a one-day exodus?
Yeah, it was everybody, one day,
okay.
One plane. gone.
And when you got the news that they were going to get rid of you, what were your actions?
Well, they were wanting to get rid of both maintainers. And so I told my captain, hey, we can't do this. You're sending both, you know, you're both your mechanics out. I've got to stay. And he was like, no, you're scheduled to go. You're going. And so we discussed it a few times. And I said, well, let's go talk to the commander. So we went and talked to the commander. And he was like, it's probably a good idea, but you're scheduled to go. And I said, well, you need to make some phone calls because you're not going to have anything left to drive. It's a harsh environment. Vehicles do not like it. So after a couple days, they were like, okay, yeah, who's staying? You're Brooks. And I was like, you want the experience or the young guy? Which do you want? And so I sent Brooks home to his wife and kid.
Good.
And I'm single, so I might as well stay. I mean,
yeah. And I think more importantly, you're experienced.
Yeah.
You know? Plus, you can handle a saw. So, you know, because this is the drawdown post-coup. Okay, so you convinced and, you know, you took initiative, which I need everybody to lead well. You know, lead well, train hard, ready now. You're leading right there. You're making sure the mission doesn't fail. You Correct. Could have gotten on that airplane and got home,
right.
You know. But you led and informed senior members, a captain, and you basically said, let's go talk to the commander
right.
to make sure that he didn't have a mission failure because you're a leader. Right. And that's leading, and that's something that I need people to do. I need people to make decisions and lead when there's no AFI, or they call them DAFIs now. There's no AFI to tell you what to do.
Right.
And you did that right there. So, you know, we didn't talk about this earlier, but that's what is in my face when we talk about this story is that you're leading and you're convincing was he a full bird colonel?
He was getting ready to put it on.
Okay. So, you know, a stubborn colonel select that you need a vehicle maintainer. He's a pilot as well.
He had a CE background.
Okay. So maybe not as hard to convince the guy that you actually have to maintain vehicles, but you led and you prevented mission failure perhaps. So
yes. You
stayed there. And then this is another part of the story where you're a multiple capable airman. So from the time you convinced the colonel to the time you actually came home and were refreshed with other vehicle maintainers, what was that duration?
Probably looking like mid-August.
Okay.
That's when they left.
So August to September, almost 2 months.
Yeah, almost 2 months.
So almost 2 months, you're in a drawdown state and you're having to do it all.
Yeah.
So talk me through, first thing you said is no sleep.
Yeah.
Because you're doing so many things that are outside your AFSC. So tell me what stuff you had to do there.
Well, you know, most flying missions at a location like that, you're going to do nighttime missions.
Okay.
So I was doing what I could of my job during the day and then would switch over to driving bus for people coming and going, you know, out to the flight line.
Vehicle trans? Is that like a vehicle maintenance and ground trans?
Ground trans.
Ground trans, you're doing ground trans job? I don't know, but I mean, I know that they have certifications and stuff like that. Are you qualified to drive these cars?
I was the only one there with a license for bus.
Okay, so would they have cared?
No.
Okay, so.
Not a bit.
So luckily, due to your experience, you had that bus driver's license, but quite honestly, they're going to take whoever. I'm sure there are people driving vehicles they weren't qualified for.
I drove a semi that I'm not qualified for, so.
that blows my mind. And then forklift, I'm sure you're qualified on forklift, but I bet you people were driving, doing stuff that they weren't qualified for, and that's okay.
Right.
Because we're not in a training environment. We're in basically a combat environment, and we're taking additional risk because the mission requires it. So awesome stuff. So vehicle trans to include the semi. Anything else cool that you drove?
Well, a skid steer.
Okay.
Working on the parking lot.
Okay.
Trying to get it to where it wasn't tearing the vehicles up as they went across it.
So you actually did some CE duties, grading the parking lot. Obviously, ground trans, not sleeping. You did some supply?
Yes.
What did that entail?
A lot of, you know, issuing, you know, clothing's getting tore up. We had very minimal supply there, but, you know, getting people back with uniforms that are messed up, some of the gear that would get tore up and...
Zero training how to do that. You're just using common sense, right?
Yeah, I was writing down a stock number and who it went to.
Okay. There you go. Common sense. So that's obviously LRS function. At least you've talked to people that that's your job. And at least when you're driving the bus and the semi, at least you've talked to people that that's their job. But you ended up doing the CE functions. What else you were doing?
Oh,
okay.
I helped them out because they still were short man because they'd still sent a couple of guys home.
Okay.
So I was out when the drones were still going, I was out fueling drones, went out fueled generators a couple times. I had one of their airmen with me.
You're refueling aircraft and drones. Okay. Awesome. You know, generator, I'm not as concerned, but you're refueling aircraft.
Right.
Okay. Did they trick you to hold the dead man switch for 30 minutes?
Yeah.
They got me that down in Peru. I wasn't going to let go, but yeah, I was tricked that. So yep, you do that once and then you try to kick that dude. A dead man switch, so people don't know, it's like when you're pumping gas out of an R11 or any fuel truck, there's a safety switch where a human is actually holding it. And if something happens, they can release it and the transfer terminates. You also were involved in PAX terminal, correct?
Yes. Yeah, I helped with the processing for people coming in and out. Luckily, the POL master sergeant took most of that responsibility.
Okay. You're not the only multi-capable airman there.
Correct.
Everybody is stepping up and getting the job done.
Yes.
Italians are still there. You're still working with them. Vehicle maintenance as well. So anything else you did? I mean, that was a two-month period. Is there anything else that would be interesting to the audience in regards to what you were doing during that period?
Well, one I hadn't told you about, out on the flight line, middle of the night, working on a K-loader for loading aircraft, and I was changing, I think, the hydraulic pump on it, main hydraulic pump. And I'm sitting out there, and I'm like thinking, man, I'm getting hungry. And I'm thinking about running back, grabbing some food, coming back. And captain shows up. The Italians brought him a pizza to bring out to me.
Okay.
So I had a fresh-made Italian pizza that they made in their pizza oven brought out to me.
Specifically to you because you've been helping them out so much. Okay.
They brought it up to give to me at the squadron building or the flight building, and I wasn't there. And they're like, oh, yeah, he's out here. And, well, can somebody take it to him? And the captain brought it on out to me.
That was probably the best tasting pizza you ever had.
Oh, it was.
Yeah.
It was fantastic.
Made by Italians in Niger on the flight line when you're working. You said it was at night.
Yeah.
That's an awesome story.
About 11 o'clock at night.
And they brought it to you because of what you've been doing for them as a you know, a NATO ally.
Right.
You know, that's awesome. It's better than German sauerkraut, right?
Well, I'm a big German food fan,
okay,
too.
Okay. So no, that's just phenomenal. And then, you know, obviously 2 months of doing it, you said this was your most rewarding deployment by far.
It's my favorite deployment I've been on. One of our other guys that's in vehicle maintenance, while he was active duty, had been to Niger. And he told me about 101, said it's his favorite deployment. And I was like, sure, let's do this. I'm ready to go. And lo and behold, I mean, it's the worst living conditions, the worst food.
Except for 11 o'clock in the flight line, Italian pizza.
Right.
Okay.
But the camaraderie that you get there.
And the job.
And the job, yes.
Yep.
It makes it all worth it.
The mission. Mm-hmm. You know, that's one thing when you look at surveys, exit surveys or whatever, everybody in our unit, and I assume it's the Air Force, wants to do the mission. You know, that's why we're in the Air Force. And, you know, you just had an opportunity that no one else in our wing has that allowed you to do the mission plus,
right?
You know, not just doing your AFSC, but you're just doing just other stuff. So would you say the last 2 months was more rewarding than the whole first couple of months?
A lot less sleep, but way more rewarding.
Isn't that awesome? Working harder. It was hotter.
Yes.
During that period too. And you enjoyed that part more. That's phenomenal. And, you know, again, volunteered, waving, not accruing dwell, deploying again. Tell me about the final duty you had out there.
My very last duty I had was, we got the PAX processed, including myself, loaded up on the bus, and I drove it out to the plane.
Okay.
And then I handed off the keys and said, I don't know how you're getting it back, but I'm not taking it.
Yeah, so the only guy that was driving the bus out there after the drawdown drove himself to the airplane and left the keys there. And we're looking at the Google Earth. That bus is still sitting right there in the middle of the ramp because no one seems to know where the keys are. So they're in your pocket, aren't they? That's a joke. The Google Earth is not that current, but it is fairly current.
It is.
What about you see where you physically lived? I see the construction of the Italian compound because it sounds like Americans are eating all their food as they're sharing the compound. But obviously, you said that wasn't awesome food overall. So, hey, Sergeant Lambert, this is a great story, and it's even better than I expected because it showed a couple things. One, your dedication to our unit and our country and the mission you do in your job. And number two, it shows leadership, that you're helping prevent mission fail by not only doing duties outside your AFSC, but making sure commanders and supervisors understand the risks that they might not see. And then it's just a phenomenal phenomenal display of multi-capable airmen. You did stuff that you never expected, you never trained, just using common sense, you know, accepting risk where risk is required, and then, you know, arming a tower with a saw. Did you ever get to shoot the saw?
No, unfortunately.
Yeah. You know, that would have probably been a story in itself.
Yeah.
But you had that respect from your fellow airmen that you were selected as augmentee, and you got the tower and the other guy didn't get the saw. So, you know.
He knew I was watching over him
though. Awesome. All right. Hey, incredible, incredible story. I really appreciate you sharing it with us. And, you know, other people here, but I really appreciate what you do. The LRS is a well-deployed, you know, combat-proven unit, and I see why. Every time I meet a member face-to-face and spend extra time, I see what type of people we have in the LRS and other units. And if you want to cross-train in security forces, I think I can get you a spot like that. Same thing with services, because they, I think, run the PAX terminal. And then, of course, you already graded the parking lot as a CE function. So operating out of four squadrons, AFSCs, yeah. That's awesome. So I appreciate your time.
Yes,
and, you know, don't be afraid to tell what you did, because it's not normal. It's exceptional. Okay. So thanks, Adam. Appreciate it.